All right, let's get this show on the road. What? What are you three hens doing in the hen house? I'm about to record a podcast episode. What, you want to stay? You want to listen? We just want to talk about watches and that's of no interest to you. You're interested? Well, okay, then I guess you can be part of the show. Just, you know, just stick in the corner of the hen house there and don't make any stories. No, Snow, you are leaving your perch. This perch is for Alex. So you just move aside at the back and no noises, no cackling from you threes while I'm recording. Is that okay? Okay, good. Well, this should do it. And yes, there'll be Alex as a co-host and he has long hair, so no picking at the long hair. Okay, it's Alex's hair. It's not yours. There's nothing inside to eat. So just leave Alex alone and be polite and no noises. Oh, this should be pretty strange. Let's go. Music. Hi, hi, everyone. Welcome to the second episode of the Vintage Hen House. First of all, thanks for the music to a good friend of mine, Nicola, which is at Picodon Conan on Instagram. Picodon, which is like the French cheese, Picodon, P-I-C-O-D-O-N underscore Conan, like the barbarian. He's a great guy, a great metalhead, good friend, and he was kind enough to do the music for me. So when you listen to that bass line, just think about Nicola with his Picodon cheese, his knife collection. Go check out his Instagram. He's a really fun guy. Special episode today because we have I have a co-host. Hi, Alex. From
Hello.
The Watch Regulator on Instagram. How are you doing? Have you found a nice perch?
A nice perch in the hen house. This is a privilege to come on, and I didn't know if even though I love vintage, I wasn't sure my vintage knowledge was at a suitable level to be on, but I'm very grateful for you having me anyway. Thank you.
Well, it's not all about vintage, but our guest today has a kind of a peculiar collection. And since you're going to get a Russian one lug watch, I think you probably fit in here. I don't know if I said so, but I'm Benoit Petit Seconds on Instagram, and today's guest is Adam from Mechanical underscore Time on Instagram. Hi, Adam. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks, Benoit. Thanks for inviting me onto the show.
It's my pleasure. I've followed your account for a long time. I think since the start of my Instagram journey, I guess. Just have such a cool collection. I think while we do wrist and drink checks, if people listening don't know Adam's account, Mechanical underscore Time, just go and scroll through the watches because it's not something you'll see very frequently on Instagram as a collection, and you may be lost if you don't just take a look at it before we have other chats. So we'll kick off with the drinks checks first, Alex. That's the right way to do it, right?
Whatever, it's your show. You can do it any way you want.
Yeah.
You want the drinks?
What are you drinking?
I am drinking an ice cold Wakichangi. Just one drink. For me today, or just two drinks, because I'm a bit hungover from the other night. So, yeah, just a nice Wakichangi.
Are you hungover from partying for dropping the Jean-Claude Beaver episode, maybe?
No, if only. I was hungover from doing the Watch Fest thing on Friday night, where I mixed far too many different types of drinks. And I think I was arguing with someone who was doing a whiskey presentation, but it was a lot of fun. But I had a bit of a hangover, and still do, so.
Was that a Zoom hangout or
yeah
real?
Zoom, yeah
like you did the other day. That's kind of a pretty strange thing. I'm not used to that. So, but I guess an ice cold Wakichangi is the Dufour simplicity of drinking. maybe right. I'm having you first, Adam. What are you drinking today?
Well, being based in South Australia, it's compulsory that I drink South Australian wine on a Sunday afternoon. So I'm having a Barossa 2018 Head Red Shiraz.
Nice.
One of my favourite labels. I don't think they're very well known internationally. They're probably not even that well known in Australia, really. But yeah, they've got some cool wines, and this one's it goes down nicely on a Sunday.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know much about Australian wine. I drank a lot of very good ones when I was there in Sydney for holiday. But are you kind of like of a wine collector or wine addict too?
No, not at all. I mean, I only started drinking red wine because, and this is a very un-Australian thing, I don't drink beer. So I had to drink something socially. And I started to look at red wine. I only drink red wine. I don't like white wine at all. That's just me. But I only know probably 10 labels that I actually like, and that's through pure chance. I just grab one and think about it and have a try. So I'm definitely no wine connoisseur at all. No.
Okay. Well, that's good too. Well, where you are, I guess it's 4:30 p.m. Where I am, it's 8 a.m. on a Sunday morning.
Mm.
So I'm having a kind of a homemade cocktail with some apple juice, some San Pellegrino, and just a touch of Don Papa rum, which is a horrible rum. So it's probably best in a sugary cocktail. So just a move. But still alcohol even at 8 a.m. in the morning because it's fifth grade.
I'm very proud of you, Benoit. I've almost got a tear in my eye. Very proud.
Let's hope you stay conscious throughout the podcast, Benoit.
Yeah. No worries. And on the wrist, I'm still doing my 1 week, one watch thing, and you'll have to get used to it because I still have about 15 weeks to do it. Where I go through all my collection and where each watch for 1 week to see if some don't pass the test. They'll probably be for sale, but this one is passing the test. It's the last day with my Panerai Radiomir 337, which is not a vintage watch, but well, you know, what the hell, that's the rules. And how about you, Alex?
I should have put a different watch on. I still have the Seiko Tuna thing that I can't remember the reference number for, which I haven't really taken. I'm just, even though I prefer vintage watches, I'm just really enjoying wearing a watch that I don't have to worry about it being water resistant or like hitting it off doors. It's a nice, relaxing thing to be able to wear this watch. So I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah, sure. Is that the solar one or am I confusing it?
No, yes, it's a solar one. I've actually been looking at even more of them as well, just in different colors and stuff. So I think something's gone wrong in my brain. I love the case shape as well. It's just something a bit different. So, yeah.
Okay, and what I'm really wondering is, what is Adam wearing? Because he has so much choice. I just wonder, what are you wearing, Adam?
Yeah, today I'm wearing something that is fairly obscure, surprisingly. It's the brand is Egosta. It's a German brand. I think it's from the 1970s. It is up on my Instagram page a few times. It's a strange-looking case. It's kind of like a 1970s ashtray that also looks like a big eye. I know that sounds very weird, but if you find Egosta, E-G-O-S-T-A, if you look up Egosta on Instagram, it'll probably be there. It's a blue watch. It's got a blue pinstripe dial. Kind of unique. I haven't seen another one anywhere ever, but it's really comfortable and it's got a very good grade German automatic movement inside by a manufacturer who's not around anymore called Förster. I looked into this movement that it has. I think it was the last automatic movement they made, and it was their flagship movement. It was considered to be the best German made automatic movement on the market at the time. It runs beautifully, and it's a yes, keeps excellent time, very smooth, sweeping seconds. It's a watch I enjoy wearing, and certainly not one I'm likely to see on anyone else's wrist as well.
What a description to say it looks like an ashtray as well. That's that really gets in your imagination, that kind of description.
I've just found it. It's got a blue striped dial.
Yeah, that's the one.
And so it's an in-house movement.
Well, I think Egosta was just they weren't a manufacturer by themselves, but they may have been aligned to Fiesta. I'm not entirely sure. Small, you know, fairly small industry around the. I think they're from Pforzheim in Germany. That's one of the what I consider one of the true German hearts of watchmaking. A few companies did use Fiesta movements. Really good movements.
Yeah, well, it's so typical of your collection. You're wearing this watch because it's the kind of stuff that you never see anywhere, and just if you try to find it, it's just a crazy watch. It's kind of it does look like an eye. It's not even an oval shape. It's like just an eye shape, and I guess you told me you would have all your watches spread out in front of you for the podcast. Is that right?
That may take some time. No, I don't. I'm not that well organized. I have them sitting in front of me, but they're in their numerous boxes.
Do you know about how many watches you have in the collection? Because it's hard to keep track of the rotation.
It is hard to keep track, and the number I'll tell you will be much less than the number that I tell my wife, of course. So that's something. It's somewhere between 70 and 80. I haven't counted properly recently, but that's the rough number.
I think that's still in an acceptable range, in my opinion. Yes. Maybe I'm the wrong person to ask, but I think that's you're under 100. You're a good bit under 100. You've still got room to grow. So,
well, no, that's what we'd like to hear. Yeah, I do have another watch box on order, Alex. So I should be doing something about that.
That's the spirit.
Getting those numbers up.
it kind of reminds me when I started the hobby. I used to collect a lot of watches, a bit in the same style as you know, like kind of unknown brands and funky cases or dials or hands. And I think I got up to about 50 or 60 watches at the time, and I was kind of flipping and trying to buy some that needed some restoration. But I've kind of very much thinned down now and brought a lot of variation in the collection, and you have no idea how good it makes me feel to know that you have like 70 watches. It makes me feel like I don't have that many. But it's mostly brands from the 50s to the 70s, right? And mostly three-handers, that's your thing?
Yeah, that's right. They probably range from the 40s to the 70s, but I don't have any vintage chronographs. They're all three-handers, just time-only pieces.
Is there a reason for that? Is it just personal, aesthetics, or
That I don't have vintage chrono?
Yeah.
I find them. They're probably. You know, I'd have to forego, say, three of my type of watches to buy one vintage chrono due to the cost difference. I mean, there are a lot of beautiful vintage chronos out there that really do appeal to me. I'm a bit scared of vintage chronograph movements, though, that something is going to snap and go wrong, and then I won't get it fixed, and I've got a dead one sitting in the watch box. But I just like the simplicity of the three-hand time-only watches. They just really appeal to me. You know, there's huge variation of designs that are out there, and that's what I enjoy most about collecting is coming across these, you know, really nicely designed pieces that aren't from a very well-known brand. It's good fun.
So I guess also that the price issue is important to you, because most of these watches, they're not very expensive, and I remember having a lot of fun of sourcing them out, and you can find great watches for even like under 200 bucks.
That's correct. Yeah, that's very true.
And you don't have a watchmaker where you are who could fix chronographs, or is that an issue where you are? Maybe.
Watchmakers in Adelaide, where I live, they have been difficult to find. I've tried a few, but I've got a really good guy now, who I've become good friends with. He's an excellent watchmaker, and at any time he's got, you know, at least one of my watches in his workshop, waiting to be serviced or repaired or whatever. So Yeah, I mean, I do have chronograph. I've got some non-vintage watches too, which occasionally pop up on my Instagram.
I saw that.
I've got a few of those are chronographs, but they're new. So, you know, I'm fingers crossed nothing goes wrong with those. But, the vintage chronographs, yeah, beautiful. I have thought many times about delving into them, but I think I'd never get out of there again. It'd be a nightmare for the bank balance.
I think you're right though about the variety. There's always going to be more three-hander watches made than chronographs.
Mm. And
your collection definitely speaks of someone who's variety is the spice of life.
Mm.
It sounds like something you'd be behind. And yeah, you're just never going to get that same amount of variety because more people have always bought 300 watches than they did chronographs. So, and I think as well, there is some sense there about not getting too into them, especially with vintage stuff. And especially the kind of stuff you would probably go for would be stuff that isn't the kind of commonplace chronograph movement. So you can be opening a can of worms there, I think.
Yeah, very good point, Alex. And the other thing is, I'm sure you both agree that, you know, the price of vintage watches just continues to go a bit silly.
Bonkers.
It's so hard. It's just getting harder and harder to find, you know, even obscure pieces that I hunt down. More and more people know about them, and prices are, it's becoming more competitive in an online auction, for instance. I've missed out on, I'm sure like everyone, you know, missed out on heaps of watches that you go, oh my God, wish I got that one. But and vintage chronographs even more so, I think, like the competitiveness for people trying to get their hands on one is just making the prices go crazy.
And even on vintage chronographs that don't have famous brands or anything, just the movement is worth so much because you can put it in a Hoyo or in a branded case and dial and have something which will go up in value by hundreds.
Mm.
So yeah, it's a very difficult market. I guess you mostly shop on eBay, or do you have other sources of a provisionment?
It's mostly eBay. I'm on eBay every day, but other sources too. You know, a lot of people have reached out via Instagram, and I've contacted people directly via Instagram as well. I've been on a few forums. I've bought from a couple of watch forums before, other just sort of online sellers. I think I bought one watch from Chrono 24 once. But yeah, it's mostly eBay.
I remember at the time spending hours and hours on end on eBay, because when you source this kind of watches, is you have to put alarms on and varied alarms.
Yeah.
So you can really find stuff that wouldn't pop up otherwise. And it takes so much time. I think a lot of people don't realize that to find these, you really have to spend a lot of time, watch a lot of products go past to know the prices, to see how they go, and it's a very, very time consuming hobby, which is a lot of fun. But at one stage I was spending so much time just following the market. And having strange, you need to put in some strange eBay searches, like in French or in German, to see things pop up that probably aren't very much seen, and then you can have a good price on them.
Ah,
yeah, that's right.
I had not thought about that at all. Oh, that's a good one. Okay, I'm stealing that.
Yeah, just put a French description. Like a montre ancienne, you know, which means vintage watch, and you'll have some people selling in France vintage watches that won't pop up if you just put vintage watch on search, because it mostly searches the titles of the objects.
Yeah.
So excellent. That's kind of a big hint.
That's why putting... when I sent you that watch the other day, that French watch, when I sent you the lip one, you were like, oh, too expensive. Too expensive.
Yeah,
you found another one that was like a quarter of the price.
And also having generic searches is important, like just vintage watch. So you'll have hundreds and hundreds of stuff every day, and you just have to look. There's some gems that are no branded. And well, that's how I used to do. I don't know how you do it, Adam.
Yeah,
same strategies.
Yeah, same, very similar strategies. I used to have things in my, you know, saved searches like NOS for new old stock under the watches category. If you sometimes, you know, you get really lucky and you find like a watch that's been put up on eBay that's been listed by someone who clearly isn't a watch person and they don't know what they're actually selling. And you can, I've done that a few times when I've come across a watch and I've gone, oh, they really don't know what they've got here. And you can use that to your advantage if you get lucky and snap something up and, you know, catch a good one. Or sometimes, you know, I've bought a watch to sell it straight away. If it wasn't really, you know, if I wanted to make a small profit, or if I just didn't, if I wasn't really feeling the watch, or whether I thought that I could just easily unsell the watch to somebody else. But most of the time, it's, you know, my searches are based on brand names of watches that I've come across over the many years of collecting. And that's how I mostly find them, rather than any other terms. But Benoit, while we're on this topic, there's one word that I do put in sometimes. It's a French word, and you have to tell me how to pronounce it. I'll give it a go. Is it plongé? Plongé?
Plongé? I don't see a
P-L-O-N-G.
Oh, for diver.
Ah, plongé. Diver, yeah, yes. Yeah. For diver, yes, plongée.
That's the one, right. French word that I know.
Oh, wow, well, I was way off. I was way off.
Plongée. Well, it's funny because you can actually search the names of brands nobody knows. Whereas when I was doing it, I was searching generic terms to stumble on watches which I've never heard of.
Yeah.
You know. So I'm guessing you've been doing this kind of collecting for a few years now?
Yeah, probably about 15 years, I think.
Oh, wow. Yes.
Yeah. My very first watch was one that was given to me by my grandmother. It was my late grandfather's watch. And it's a 1972 Omega Geneva automatic. I think it's got the caliber 562 automatic in it. And that's what really started me off on the appreciation of not only watches, but just, you know, quality items and small mechanical things. And Omega today, they remain my favorite brand overall. But yeah, it's a beautiful watch. It's simple. It's nothing too fancy, but it every time I pick it up, it starts, you know, you just lift it out of the box and it runs straight away. It's beautiful. It's beautiful to wind, you know, good feeling through the crown. And when it, because it's a gold plated watch, not solid gold, unfortunately, but I think, you know, the way vintage gold watches catch the light, you know, in slightly low light, they seem to be really warm, don't they? And that's what I really like about vintage watches is the different colors you get in the light, depending on the angle and that sort of thing. Just so well done.
And there are so many gold types in vintage watches from these eras because they were all using different alloys depending on their relations or who they worked with. So you get, I had an Omega Seamaster like yours, which was pink gold plated and a very, very odd pink, you know, very beautiful. And it had probably patinaed over the time. And the good thing about the Omega gold-plated watches, at least in the 50s and 60s, is that they were heavily plated, quite thick.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not like modern plating. It's a totally different... I mean, I don't even think you could call the modern stuff that brands do. It's not proper gold plating. It's something... It's like a gold PVD or something. But the old gold plating, which you see... It was designed that it could take a polish and stuff like that. There's enough of it there that it was a quality gold plating compared to modern equivalents.
And your Omega is a real family piece because it was it's been in your family for a long time. And I think on Instagram, when you show it, it's usually you have a special event or family time.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, I do like to wear it. It is in rotation along with the others, but I probably wear it less than the others. And I'll wear it on Christmas Day, or maybe on my birthday, my grandfather's birthday, or special occasions like that. It's one of those watches that I'll never sell, no matter what. I'll never sell it.
Of course. But how do you, because you started with this watch, which you could have gone any way possible in your collecting. So how do you end up with all these kind of unheard of French, German mostly, and some Soviet too, and of course Swiss watches? What's the way into this? Because you have a couple of modern pieces, which maybe you have since before you started collecting these old ones, or the other way around, I don't know.
Yeah, I think that I got into vintage watches not straight away after the Omega, because I was too young to wear it for a while. I've always liked watches in general, so I bought some, over the years, some more modern ones, and I just started to think, well, that's a fair bit of money to spend on a watch, so what can I get that's well made, mechanical, and looks nice, and is from Switzerland or France or Germany or wherever? And that's when I started to, research mechanical vintage watches, either manually wound or automatic. And really, my collecting philosophy is first and foremost on design. I look when I scroll through eBay endlessly or wherever else, if the design doesn't catch my eye, no matter what the brand is, then I won't show further interest in it. The design has to catch my eye first, then I will look at it, then I'll look at the brand name, then I'll research the brand name, and if it's got a bit of an interesting history or whatever, even if it doesn't, if I like the design, then that's it. But usually it's they do have an interesting history. Sometimes no matter how deep you dive into Google or whatever, there are some brands that I cannot find any information on at all. They're mystery brands. And I do try to search in German and French language as well. I go that deep into it. But some of these brands, they were just must have been tiny private labels that, they just put their name on a dial, got somebody else to make the whole thing, which is very common back in those days and still is, and just put sold watches out there because, there's who knows how many actual, even just in Switzerland itself, not a big country geographically, but who knows how many watch brands have come and gone since, the 1920s, 30s, 40s onwards.
Yeah, and I remember I once found a watch which was just labeled GP, like Girard Perregaux.
Yes.
And it was a beautiful gold-plated with a sector dial, insane condition, very elegant watch. And I tried searching, and I was asking my watchmakers. And it's probably easier for me here because there's still a lot of history around on all these watches, which isn't necessarily on internet. And, watchmakers here see a lot of these kind of watches, so they kind of get to know them. And basically what my watchmaker explained me is it was probably someone who started his company and who was doing door-to-door sales.
Oh, yes.
And he basically had a bunch of watches made. He made 300 watches, had made the cases somewhere and had them assembled elsewhere. And basically he was selling his watches like a door-to-door, like a door-to-door salesman.
Mm.
And, no real brand, nothing, or sometimes just on catalogs. And you sometimes find watches like that, a brand like Arvor, which maybe you have heard of, ARVOR, which I had a couple, which is basically someone in France who was selling watches mostly in the northwest of France, in Bretagne. And he made up this brand, and his main selling point was northwestern France. So it's very peculiar watches, but well made, all just assembled from different case and hands and dial manufacturers. It's just unthinkable to think that at the time in the 50s, in the 60s, there were all these different options to buy a watch. No, they were not just ADs, but so many different kind of watches you could buy.
So they were like the micro brands of their time, going door to door. I mean, it's pretty much the same way where they're more direct to consumer now, the micro brands, and it's just the same thing, except there was no, like, we've got the internet now to keep records of all these brands, so they'll never truly vanish, but those ones, yeah, just no records exist. I think it makes it all the more kind of romantic and stuff to collect them.
Yeah, and basically, I guess they probably just put ads in newspapers, you know? Like, and there was also all this thing about communion watches. So there was a big market in communion watches at the time where, you know, you got offered your first watch for your Catholic communion. And there were lots of brands which were on that segment. Not even brands, just people selling watches which were on that segment too. And it's mostly three-handers and maybe gold-plated. So, but, you know, just coming back to your collection, Adam, what's really interesting is that since you've been doing this for 15 years, you can actually search the names no one knows.
Yeah.
which is pretty unique. But so mostly it's design driven then. And then you do a deep dive.
Right? Yeah, correct. Yeah, that's right. And, you know, I try to find, correct me if I'm wrong if you see something in there in the collection, but I try to find a different looking watch every time, you know, even something really subtle that's different from anything else I've bought before, you know, whether it be the color of the dial, the way the hands are, the hour markers, the case shape, even the, you know, the dial finishing, that sort of thing. There's just never-ending diversity of design in the decades that have come before us that I really, really enjoy seeking out. You know, and from, you know, the big three, Switzerland, France, and Germany, there are different levels of quality in all three countries in watches. But, you know, overall, some of these vintage pieces I've got, back in the day, they would have been really good brands. Well, you know, really high quality, well executed brands, and many of them are in house. They've got in house movements. They've made cases and dials and what have you in house as well. And they just weren't marketed or distributed as strongly as your Omegas and Rolexes and all the other big names that we all know. But today, if you were to, you know, try to match the quality and the in-house capability of some of these obscure vintage watches, you'd be looking at, you know, a $10,000 plus watch to achieve the same outcome, I think. You know, that's what some of these micro brands actually attempt to do when they get serious about it. But, you know, I've got a Swiss brand called Buser, B-U-S-E-R, Buser Freres, probably mispronouncing that as well. But they were quite a big brand. I think they made for other brands too. But, you know, they had fully in-house movement, designed and manufactured. And it's a beautiful-looking movement. And, you know, to achieve a similar level of quality today would be very expensive. So that's why I consider some of these vintage watches to be real bargains, because you've got the kind of the equivalent, the aged equivalent, of a much more expensive watch on your wrist that still runs beautifully and, you know, looks really nice.
I think I was saying this to someone recently, actually, on one of the podcasts, was when you look through the vintage stuff on eBay, and if you actually look at all the watches, if you don't just look at the Omegas and the Longines, like, if you look at the similar ones from the same period, you can see, like, there's a difference in quality sometimes. And then you look at the Omega and it's like $1,000. And then you look at something else and it might be the same quality or even slightly better, or sometimes a lot better, and it's like $250. And lots of people are just in the vintage game. They just look for the names that they recognize, because they're not willing to take a chance on the brands that they've never heard of before, which is why I think you've done so well, because you're just like, you can see the quality in these things. These are like really well-designed pieces as well that you're getting. So I think that's why you've found your kind of niche and have taken advantage of that.
And also what I would say is that today in vintage watch collecting, everyone is looking for the very rare piece or, you know, the very special piece and paying awfully high prices for all the brands that we know of, you know, from Rolex to Patek Philippe or whatever. But if you want a really rare watch, something very special with in-house movements, you know, just scroll through Adam's inventory. We'll call it an inventory. But, you know, you can find so many awesome watches. I remember buying Helvetia watches, kind of a not very well-known brand, which was a branch of the Omega Group. It wasn't even the Omega Group at the time, but and they made stupendous movements, equivalent to Omega or Rolex. And you can find them for very cheap, and they're already expensive compared to a lot of even more obscure brands. But you know, you get something very, very rare, so kind of unique, and very good quality for a very cheap price. And I think it's all it's all to your honor to have this kind of collection and to put forward all these small watches saying, hey, look, you can have fun with a low budget and have great watches on the wrist.
Yeah, that's
even
right.
In Australia.
Well, Australia, it's expensive to collect watches because of the distance for shipping. Shipping costs out of Europe and the USA are pretty bad. I've bought a watch many times where the shipping cost is the same or more than the watch itself. So, you know, you've got to look at it from that perspective. That and it takes forever. It can take up to a month or more. And I'm talking pre-COVID. It can take up to a month or more to get something out of Germany or France or USA in the post. And we all know how stressful that is, waiting and tracking it, and then there's the tracking seems to stop. You have a mini heart attack when that happens, but you don't have to spend a lot of money to get high quality if you can seek out and take your chance, like Alex said, on brands that you know you might not know much about. And nowadays, Instagram itself is a research tool. I have found many brands that I haven't heard of, old brands that don't exist anymore, on Instagram, just, you know, through people I follow and just random posts that might come up. And you go, oh, I haven't heard of that brand before. Then you look into it and you realize that it's, they used to be really good back in the day. And it's another brand that comes onto the radar as one to seek out. So Instagram is a really good research tool for vintage watches. I've never seen any other place that is as good as Instagram for having lots and lots of excellent photos to look at, and a really good place to chat to people who are enthusiastic and knowledgeable in the field of vintage watches. It's fantastic.
And that's exactly what we're doing here. I was wondering, because on your profile picture, and for a long time now, it's the Sabina. Yeah. Which is one of my favorite watches from your collection, because it's got everything. It's got a brilliant case shape. I'm guessing it's gold plated, but maybe it's even 18 karat gold. I don't know, and it doesn't matter really. But you know, that dial and the hands. Is there a story behind this one? Is it a personal favorite of yours?
It is. Yeah, I'm holding it right now. I'm looking at this one. I wore it the other day. I had been on the search for a Sabina watch. I've been looking for Sabina. I came across them a while back, and I thought they've got some nice designs. And I'm not 100% sure where I found this particular one, but and when I saw it, I thought, oh my God, that is just fantastic. It's got so many beautiful design elements about it. You know, the numerals, just the font of the numerals. The case shape, it's actually kind of like it's a rose gold. It's got the teardrop lugs, which aren't that obvious if with some of my photos from front on. I should show the watch from side on. The teardrop lugs, they go right down away from the case. They're angled away from the case very sharply. And it's, yeah, it's got, you know, the lance hands. I just like everything about it. It's a beautiful condition. It's a real relic from the past, that one. It's a real favourite of mine. It works very well too. Keeps good time.
The numerals on that are really incredibly beautiful. Like, you don't see something like that very, very often. So I can totally understand why you snapped it up.
Yeah, I think that's a good one.
Yeah, I guess it's a generic movement in it, maybe. I don't think they were making specific movements. No?
Yeah, they didn't. I think I haven't cracked open the back in a while, but I think it was Adolf Schild, I think.
Yeah.
It was one of the one of the big main Swiss suppliers.
I like on some of those vintage pieces, it's not Swiss on the dial, it's Suisse.
Yes.
Suisse. And sometimes you have also a Switzerland on the dial. And I just love finding those details where, you know, it's just that little detail that makes a great design difference.
Yeah, I've got some that say Fab Swiss, Fabrication Swiss as well. I guess that's probably, would that be for the French market, Benoit, if they say Swiss in the, you know, the French spelling of the word Swiss?
I have no idea. I don't think there were that many rules at the time. Maybe starting from the late 60s to the 70s, the brands kind of made all these signs generic. But I mostly see the variations from the early 60s and the 50s. Pieces.
Okay. Yeah.
So I'm guessing, but I have no idea. If I don't think there were specific rules for the French market concerning Switzerland, but it's kind of one of those many unanswered questions. And honestly, I would be hard picked to choose which ones are my favorite from your collection, because there's so much variety and choice. And the Sabina stands out, of course. There's also that Selza with coffin markers.
Yeah, that's a nice one.
Yeah, which is amazing because it's got the simplest of designs, very classic, with just those coffin markers. And I am guessing that they catch the light in a way which is really awesome.
Yeah, they do. That's a really nicely designed watch. It's quite a contemporary design, really, when you think about it. I'm guessing that was... It looks to be 1960s to me, but if you research Selza, they were you know, quite a good Swiss brand, and that watch in particular is very well made. It's got an excellent all stainless steel case. The movement is not by Selza, although I believe they did their own adjustments on the movements they put in, and they did stamp their logo on them as well. Not everyone can be bothered with that. Putting their own logo on a movement, you see tons and tons of vintage watches with nothing on the movement at all, or only 17 jewels or something like that, or just the word Swiss. But Selza went a bit further than that. They were a good brand. And they also had some pretty cool advertisements. I'm also into vintage watch adverts, the ones that, the ones that people... there are some people who saved them, they cut them out of newspapers or magazines and what have you, but there's some, I think the standards of watch advertising, it was much classier back in the 40s, 50s and 60s than it is today. There was more elegance to it. There were no celebrities, which is fantastic in my opinion. don't get me started on that. They're just beautifully elegant adverts of some of these Swiss brands and French and German brands for that matter too. Beautiful adverts, very elegant designs, and that really capture the the feeling you get from putting on one of these watches. Just the design of the advert themselves, the way they're laid out, it's really done, really well done. Compared to today, there are a few good adverts getting around, but I really do prefer the vintage adverts for watches, different era.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, is what's your take on on today's watch world, you know, because you're kind of in your bubble with your old vintage unique pieces. But do you follow contemporary watchmaking or?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I do.
Houdinki or SGX or things like that?
I do. Not so much Houdinki. That's probably, that may be the topic of another podcast altogether.
Go on. Say it all. Say it all. Hey, Alex.
Go on. You can say where. All. Yeah, you're. Be feel yeah, right.
Whatever you
here.
Want.
Yeah.
You sure? You
this
sure,
is Ben? The place. Yeah. Yeah. Go.
Ben is Ben Clymer listening in? Is he going to really solicit on board or?
Who cares? Who the fuck cares?
I used to follow them quite closely because they, you know, years ago they were really pushing the whole vintage. You know, the revival of interest in vintage watches. And I thought, wow, you know, they've got some good articles. They're showing some good pieces. I like what they're doing. And then, you know, sooner or later, it just turned into a monetization exercise for them. And some of their, you know, their limited edition items they became involved in, I thought, oh, no, here we go again. The Houdinki shop, As is the general consensus, the prices are laughable. You know, there was that recent example of that 8-day alarm clock, vintage alarm clock. I know that's all over. I don't need to say any more about that. It's been done to death on online. But I hold them responsible for making vintage watch collecting more expensive because they you know they opened up too many people's eyes, Benoit and Alex, and you know, it's made it more expensive to seek out these pieces because they were very good at hyping up forgotten brands. And all of a sudden, everyone knows about a certain brand. And I thought, oh God, I used to be the only one who knew about. Or I thought I was only one of the only people who knew about this brand or this design or whatever. But
what brands are you thinking about? Because I'm newer to the hobby than you, so I don't, I didn't follow Houdinki 10 years ago. So what brands are you thinking about when you're saying
well,
this?
Well, it's brands that I don't actually own because they rapidly became too expensive for me to own. And I didn't, I'm not one who sort of buys what everyone else has got either. You know, I used to love, and I still do love, and they're also one of my favourite ever watch brands. I think they're they've got some of the best designs of all time, Universal Geneva.
yes, of course.
That's what I was going to say, yeah.
Just superb. They're absolutely superb. When you think you've seen one of the nicest designs you've ever seen, along comes another vintage UG. But, you know, if I remember correctly, they were hyping that brand. And I thought, oh, no.
Patek. They kept on comparing it to Patek, didn't they?
Yeah. When I started collecting, when I try to think back now at what I could have bought at the time for the price, you just kick yourself thinking, you know, no one really. It was before these certain brands or certain models really blew up, thanks to the internet, which you also use to your advantage, of course, but. You know, vintage watch collection can have some sort of selfishness about it. Once you discover an obscure brand, you kind of don't, you know, you're in two minds about, oh, do I put this one out there because it's, you know, others are going to see it now, and then if I want to get another one, it'll be harder to find. There'll be less of them around, or they'll become more expensive. But I guess that's just collecting in general. You know, it is a bit of a competition you have with other people that you don't know and haven't ever met, but
it's kind of a double-edged sword because
yes.
You want to share the secrets or what you found,
yeah.
But if you share it too much, you know, I'm actually thinking about bleeping out what I said about the eBay searches.
That's what I was going to say, that you should do that, at least until I get a chance to go through and find all the stuff that I want to find. then you can release it a second time.
And it's difficult because when you find gems and whatever it is, if it's the movement, if it's the brand, if it's, you know, like a really good deal, you want to share it, but you don't want to share it too much.
Yeah.
Like Kevin said in the first episode, I had Kevin O'Dell, and when I asked him what his next watch was going to be, He said, well, I'm not going to say because people are going to start looking for it and I'll have a hard time finding one. So, and that's exactly it. So, we're on a thin line here.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
But, I know. Well, you know, it's nice to have that insight because, you know, I've only been collecting for what, maybe 4 years or so. So, and, you know, I at the start, I was only really concentrating on my eBay searches, on watch fairs and stuff like that for old vintage watches. And I didn't even follow Hodinkee or know about them or whatever. But it's fun to have that background of where they started from and what they've become. And but so you still follow, you know, like SIHH or Baselworld or whatever it's going to be?
Yeah, I do.
From a distant eye, maybe.
Yeah, and I mean, in Australia, that, you know, watches aren't as huge or as big of the culture as they are in Europe, for instance. And in where I live, watch spotting in the wild is a very sad affair. There is very, very little to be seen, other than some of my personal friends. But yeah, it's especially vintage watches. But I do follow, you know, the watch fairs. I'm very interested in new brands, new releases from established brands. It's very, very hard to keep up though with all the micro brands that are out there. Some of them do some good things though. And I've followed a lot of them over the years. So, yeah, I definitely still am very interested in the watch industry as a whole, how it's going, what's being released. And I think there's been some cracking new releases in 2020 in particular. I was just looking at they're fairly obscure. They've only got one model out at the moment, but the brand is called Tulloch, Tulloch.
Never heard of it.
Yeah, oh, absolutely superb watch. A beautiful design. They are on Instagram, so maybe have a look at them, the independent brand. Tulloch Official. If you look up Tulloch Official. Yeah,
that's beautiful. Awesome movement. Incredible.
Oh, you're very high in movement. Designed. Yeah, it's okay. Incredible. Incredible brand.
I've never heard of them. That's amazing. Amazing stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, either, but so basically maybe more into modern independence then.
I definitely do like the modern independence. I still follow the big names. I've got a bit of disdain for some of them, but it's just, you know, never ending so-called limited editions, of which my favorite brand is extremely guilty of, Omega, but I still love them. Other brands, you know, it's just never-ending releases and some good stuff too. Of course, I'm sure this has already been discussed, but, you know, vintage reissue is still extraordinarily popular. And I don't mind it. I think Longines do it very well as a brand that comes to mind straight away. They've had some real winners over the last couple of years of, you know, delving into their back catalogue and releasing some, re-releasing, I should say, some of their vintage models that stay relatively true to what they were, except if they try a bit of, you know, faux patina, as we call it. Mm-hmm. I'm not a fan of that. That's just my personal opinion. But yeah,
it's difficult when you're collecting vintage and you get to handle or see up close these pieces.
Mm.
When they come out with a reissue, you just think, yeah, it's nice, it's cool, but it just doesn't do it. I have a very hard time finding a reissue which I really like.
Mm.
I always hover back to the original model.
Yeah, somehow. It's so difficult. You're so right. Yeah, when you look at the original one and you look at the new one and you're like, it's kind of, I don't know, in my mind, it triggers something. I'm like, this isn't the real thing. Like, this is a bit of a fake thing.
Well, it's a replica, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
It's not an original that they're putting out there. And 99.9% of the time, you know, they go bigger.
Yep.
Which is, you know, kind of anti-vintage because vintage the sizes of watches has grown over the years. I'm very, very anti-huge watch. I don't like anything much bigger than like 42 mil is my maximum for a watch.
Yeah.
But I've got watches ranging. I've got, you know, one starting at 32 mil, and I do have a 42 mil watch too. So side by side, they look quite ridiculous, but can wear them. You can get away with wearing them.
It's exactly the same for me. And what I have trouble with these vintage vintage re-editions is that when Longines came out with a three-hander for the military or for the aviation or a gold dress watch, it was because at the time when they put it out, it had a meaning, it had a usefulness. But there is no use in 2020 to come out with a vintage military with four patina dial. There's absolutely no use to it. So you've got no history, no reason to buy it. Just, you know, if you want to buy a watch today, you'd be better off buying a G-Shock or an independent watch, because or a modern design which speaks. I often do the comparison because I used to have a Royal Oak, which was from 2004, so which is a we could call a reissue from the original 70s watch. And I really liked that watch. And what in the end didn't do it for me was because it was a reissue. And I sold it and I bought an Octo Finissimo, because that's a modern watch. That's a watch you want to wear today in 2019, in 2020.
Yeah, I love that.
It's something that couldn't be done at the time. It's something that has a meaning today. Whereas if you buy a reissue of a 1940s chronograph, we don't need aviation chronographs with Valjoux movements anymore. We just don't need them. There's no real sense in bringing this out today. So you're kind of losing on part of the history of the piece, I find, in my personal opinion, with these reissues. And the latest example is the Aquastar, which everyone is talking about on social media. And they're doing a very good reissue. I have no problem with it, but come on, just put them side by side. And it had a meaning at the time, and it was an important watch at the time, but today it's just ridiculous.
My issue with reissues is it always seems like a bit of a cash grab. Like, especially now, it's just like the next thing for the marketing people to make money from and to kind of just bleed it dry. It's kind of the same. I think it was the same for a long time with the whole Swiss made thing. And now Swiss made doesn't really mean anything. And now they're tending to do the same thing with both vintage reissues and in-house movements. And soon in-house movement, I think, isn't going to mean anything either, because everyone's going to be doing it. None of them are going to be really properly in-house. And it's just, they seem to kind of latch on to things. And rather than letting them exist and letting them be a bit special and kind of dipping into it every now and again, they just kind of keep on going until basically the public's had enough of it. And then they just move on to the next thing and bleed that to death. And that's why I get that feel a bit with not all vintage reissues, but a lot of them, sadly.
Yeah, I get your point, and I tend to agree as well. But I also think there are some vintage reissues that do hit the spot for reasons of the fact that, you know, the originals have become too hard to find, or you can't find a good one in good condition, or you're too scared to buy a vintage watch. You think it's going to break as soon as you wear it, but you love the design, so you want to get a new version of that look that you like, and not have, you know, really much worry about the reliability or the fragility of the watch.
And I have a perfect example for that, which is a collector on Instagram, which I recommended in the last episode, which is AV Manu Watches, and he is collecting mostly vintage military chronographs, so, you know, all the Dodan, all the Breitlings, and all the flybacks and stuff. And he bought the reissue of the Breitling vintage chronograph, you know, the black one, which came out a few months ago, which is a lot like the Breguet Type 20. And he bought the reissue, and his caption on the post was, "Well, I just can't find a vintage one for years, so I bought the reissue," which is a really good reissue. So that's kind of a fun example, because he's really into the vintage hard ground stuff, And he just couldn't find that Breitling, which is an uber rare watch.
That's right.
Rarer than Breguet's. And so basically he just bought the reissue and he's probably very happy with it.
Yeah, I think they can serve a purpose. And I mean, I was personally involved in the vintage reissue with the EZA brand, EZA. They're out of, it's an old German brand.
Oh, yeah.
And now I had a couple of EZA automatic new old stock skin divers.
Wow.
And I had the black dial and the blue dial version, and I've never ever seen them online anywhere else ever since then, and I bought them a few years ago. And I noticed in 2016, a guy who's now a friend of mine, because we've worked together on the vintage reissue, Adrian Tramp from EZA Watches, him and a friend, another Dutch guy, they relaunched the EZA brand because they liked what EZA had done in the past in terms of their designs, and they were, you know, a relatively unknown small brand. And he found me on Instagram, and he said, I really like, you know, I see you've got some EZAs, and I really like them. And he actually bought, because I had two, I snapped up two from the one buyer, and I thought, these are great. I like the blue and the black. He actually bought one of them off of me. And then I sent him a message after that, and I said, look, you know, if perhaps we can do something together and relaunch this one. Let's make a modern exact copy of it, really, and redo it. And I forgot that I even sent him that message. It would have been a year or two, I think, or it was some time had passed, and he sent me a message. He sent me a reply and said, all right, let's do it. Can you help me out? So I became involved in this project where we both had the original EZA Skin Diver automatic watch that we possessed, the one I sold him and the one I retained myself. And it took us a good 6 months of lots of WhatsApp messaging and Zoom calling and all that sort of thing to relaunch two versions of the original. One was exactly the same dimensions as the original. It was 36 millimeter, which in today's, you know, new watch world is tiny to most people. But he stayed faithful to the size of the original, and for commercial purposes, he also released a slightly larger version of the same design. And that was a really fun project to be involved in because, you know, I helped him out with delving into the real history of EZA brand, a small brand that were based out of Pforzheim in Germany. Again, it had a really, really good a German-made automatic movement in it that was equal to just about anything at the time. You know, quite a high-tech movement for it back in the day. In the vintage version I'm talking about. And it was a really fun project to work on. You know, it's one person from South Australia, one person from the Netherlands working to relaunch an old defunct German watch that was a really good project to work on. And he's actually a watchmaker. He's a qualified watchmaker himself. So, you know, he took things very seriously. He did the adjustments on the movement and the timing and all of that. So it was, that we launched that in January of this year. It's called the EZA 1972, and because that's when the original model was made.
Wow, I had no idea about this, honestly.
Right.
And it's really funny because Rob from the Fifth Risk Crew, which sells independent watches, he's a big fan of EZA watches. Am I right, Alex?
Yeah, I was about to say that. Yeah, I'm sure he's like the Australian retailer or something, but he always speaks very highly of the guys that started up that brand, so it was a bit surreal when you started talking about them.
Yeah, same here. I had no idea. Of course, I had seen that EZA on your feed, and I immediately did the parallel with the micro brand, because you can say it's a micro brand.
It is a micro brand, yeah. But it's a relaunched brand that is also a micro brand. I've got an EZA Sealander, which is the first model they actually came out with, which is not a vintage reissue at all. It was a one of their own designs. But it was after that that we got talking about, let's do the 1972, the one that we both have. And we did. So I helped him with the packaging design. You know, the box and the packaging should look like. And I said to him, you know, you should have a swing tag on it, because back in the day, vintage watch boxes had, you know, a swing tag, and sometimes they had a little wax seal on them, and you know, so I was going into vintage watch box design, and to help him, you know, really do it correctly.
Yeah, that's awesome. Beautiful. Yeah, that's awesome. I had no idea.
What a great project to be part of. That's like every really watch enthusiast's kind of dream, isn't it? To be part of something like that. And I guess that's where your passion for all the advertising and stuff you were talking about earlier as well. Mm-hmm. That probably came across in you kind of knowing, okay, this is kind of how it should look, and this is how things were back then. So,
excellent. Yeah, man, I got a lot of. He was sending me, you know, the prototype images of the case, the dial, and the proportions. We wanted to make sure we got all the proportions right and as close to possible within, you know, modern manufacturing tolerances as we could get to the original. So I've got a lot of photos on my phone of the prototyping process of making the watch, which was interesting because I hadn't been involved in anything like that before. And with him being a watchmaker, he could, you know, he had insights and ideas that I didn't, because I'm not a watchmaker. So yeah, it was really good to work with him.
And that's a vintage reissue, which of course means something to you. So
yeah,
it kind of brings I had no idea, and it kind of brings some to me. It kind of brings some legitimacy to bringing this out, because you know it's passionate people. It comes from a collector like you, which had the original watches and still has one, and they are very rare to find. It's true that the parallel between all these forgotten brands and today's micro brands is very close. They are very closely related, and one of the examples is your Dubois watch. You have a Dubois, a boho style watch, which I found beautiful, and when I saw it the first time, what's good with your account is that you give some details often of the brands, of what you find out about them. So the Dubois is from the Dodan family, and it speaks to me because it's where I live. So it's kind of sentimental, and Dodan is a big thing here. When I started looking, I discovered that there was actually a micro brand called Dubois, which made modern watches.
Do you mean Le Bois?
Yeah. Le Bois, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not Dubois, but Le Bois.
Yeah, they got relaunched as well. That's correct.
Yeah, and it's fun to see that all these micro brands who are searching for a part of legitimacy and the watchmaking history, they go to these, and then I think you got featured in their feed with your Le Bois.
I was, yeah.
and then I just clicked and I saw, well, the brand is kind of an investor group who launched it up kind of artificially. I discovered, but it's fun to see how yesterday's forgotten brands kind of come back in these different ways, be it Eza or be it Le Bois or maybe many others that we don't know about.
Well, I think Dubois also, they died and they came back as well. In fact, I contacted them right when they were in the process of relaunching. I discovered them I discovered them on Instagram, where they had like a teaser where they just put their logo up or something. And I think I found them on the hashtag of Dubois, and I thought, oh, I've got a Dubois. They claim to be the oldest Swiss watch factory in existence. So I had a Dubois alarm watch, you know, two crown alarm watch, probably from the 60s, I think. And I reached out to them and had a good talk to them as well. I can't remember the guy's name. He's still fairly active. The Dubois brand is still active and still on Instagram. But it was good chatting to him as well. He's very passionate about the brand. They got a pretty cool logo. I think it's like a tree or something. It's like a fir tree of some sort. But I am into watch logos. I mean, and that is, I guess that's a key part of watch design, is the logo on the dial or elsewhere. And again, you know, a lot of the time it's just a word, but there's some really cool logos out there that have existed over the years that make it interesting. You know, I've bought watches just based on what the logo looks like because I liked it. Simple as that.
Yeah, I've just looked them up. Dubois et Fils, yes, in Basel.
Mm.
I didn't know that they actually existed.
Yeah, they're still going. They're still releasing new models too.
This is like a never-ending mine digging, you know.
Yeah.
Just keep digging. And just finding stuff and finding it never ends. Crazy. So.
Can I ask about one of your watches? And
yes.
Just when you're talking about names and logos and stuff like that, I don't even know where to begin trying to say the name of this brand properly. Mm-hmm. But the design on the, it was the first watch that kind of jumped out to me on your profile. So I'll spell the brand name to you because I don't want to butcher it too much.
Yeah. It's
Pringeps. How the hell do you say that?
Well,
Pringeps. Yeah. No.
Pringeps. Yeah.
I guess
they're it's an Italian brand that had their watches made in Switzerland. That's a really odd looking watch. That one. It's the one that's kind of that bullhead case without the horns. It's
Yeah,
it's a very strange watch. That's an Italian brand that had quite a few designs. They're still going, but they're not the same. You know,
They're still going. Okay.
Yeah, they're still going, but they're more fashion. They're fashion kind of watches. A lot of brands, sometimes you see people get hold of these old brand names. They buy the intellectual property or whatever, and they just make the mass market cheap fashion watches, and it's really tragic.
I mean, there's a certain amount of fashion to this one as well, though, right? I mean, it's such a polarizing design of watch. I urge everyone to go on to mechanical_time and have a look at this thing. The case is, when you started to talk about the other watch earlier on, and you were saying it was like a 60s ashtray or something, I think there's definitely like that same kind of design feel to this.
Yeah.
And the hour markers on it are huge, and they all look about 4 feet tall.
They're very tall.
Crown at 6 o'clock. But it's such a cool, it really kind of sums up your collection for me, actually. I don't think everyone would be able to pull this off or want to pull this off, but it's so of the time when this watch would have come out in the 70s. People would have bought this and thought they were like the coolest person, like showing off to everyone, because it's such a cool design.
It is. It's pure 1970s because it's got so many chunky elements to it and bright colors, which are two hallmarks of the 70s in terms of watch design. The hour markers, they're like fried eggs on toast. They're strange. They are really tall, and again, it's hard to portray that on a flat screen where you don't have the real thing in front of you. But the case itself, I think it appears to be that sandblasted or frosted finish.
Yeah,
the case is quite bulbous. It's higher at the bum than it is at the head at the top, so the whole case is angled back. Again, you can't really see that very well in the photo or the video. I tried to show it in the video a little bit. If you're looking at the photo, I think you're looking at fairly recently. If you click on the video, you'll see me do a bit of a wrist roll. But I'd have to show you from side on what this thing really looks like, because it's not symmetrical.
And it's not a huge difference in the kind of, it's not a massive dip, right?
No, it's not. No, yeah, it's pretty subtle.
It's very subtle.
It'd be maybe 2 millimeters. It's a bit of a bastard to wind it because the crown is hard up against the strap. So you've really got to let your fingernails grow a little bit so you can pop that crown out and wind it. But yeah, the dial itself is got that, it's not really a gradient dial. It's kind of, well, it almost is, but it's kind of that vintage smoked dial where it's darker on the outer circumference.
Fumé.
Yeah, fume, yeah. Yeah, it's a fume dial. So it's got a lot going on, as you said, Alex.
Yeah.
And there's a crown on the dial. There is a crown on the dial.
Yeah.
Yes, there is. I was going to do a post just about how many watch brands have come and gone that have a crown on the dial, and Rolex was not the first to have a crown as their logo. Countless brands have had a crown as their logo, and Princeps, if that's how you say it, is one of them. Another watch I've got with a crown as the logo is Midas or Midas, M-I-D-A-S. Yes. So many brands have used the crown. It must have been the done thing back in the day. But, yeah, that's a funny-looking watch, that one. It's not very comfortable either, I'll admit. it's weird. It's a weirdo watch.
I think that sums up the whole, like, that period of time, though, where it was, like, design and style over everything else. It's correct, there's no, yeah. you look at this, and there was at no point did they take this to someone and they said, no, like, we can't do that. Like, that's, we can't have, like, the hour markers are too big or too tall. No, you can't have, like, that difference in height from top to bottom. Like, there was just, somebody came up with a design and took it to someone, and this person said, yes, we can do all of those things. There's no holding back. And for me, that's one of the reasons why I like that period of time the most, and especially for Omega as well. I know there's a guy I work with, Dono, and he loves that period as well, because brands were just trying all kinds of stuff. And mainly, I think, because the quartz crisis was there, and they were like, we need to really focus on design, because we maybe don't have the technology as much anymore. So you get all these really amazing, wonderful things, and that's so much of that is seen in your collection.
That's very true. The 70s in particular was the real time of experimentation in design. They did go all out, and I think you're right. They were, you know, because the quartz crisis was putting pressure and ended up killing off hundreds of brands, they were just trying to get noticed still and hang in there by coming up with these outlandish looking, big, chunky, colourful, strange designs, so that hopefully people would buy them and not buy that, you know, that bland quartz watch that has just come out.
Yeah.
And yeah, you're totally right. And this is a pretty good example of that. It goes quite to the extreme end. But when you think of other things that were designed in the 70s, there were a lot of rounded shapes, chunkiness in general, the introduction of bright colours. You know, one may call it a bit ugly, but I call it interesting and full of character.
Also, this watch has a good movement because it's 25 joules, so
yeah,
maybe that's kind of rare, because often in the 70s, the movements weren't always that good because they're competing against the quartz ones.
Yeah, that's right. I think movement quality for mechanical watches in the 70s, it took a little bit of a dip. They weren't at their best. You know, I think 50s and 60s is where it's at for me with movements, non-chrono movements I'm talking.
I mean, you've even got that, I think it's a Tissot with the plastic with the plastic gears.
Yeah, it's a Lanco.
Yeah, a Lanco, sorry.
Yeah, it's a Lanco, which was owned by the Omega Tissot conglomerate at the time, but it's got the Tissot Astralon plastic movement, really interesting movement. I did like Lanco. I was looking for Lanco, but I was also hunting for any watch brand with that movement in it, because I thought it was a precursor to the Swatch, the plastic Swatch watch. It's just such an interesting, innovative movement. You know, it's got no oils. It's mostly plastic. It's dust, you know, sealed in a dustproof case. You can, it looks cheap, but it does, and it feels a bit, I don't know, if you haven't owned one, you've got to experience firsthand what it feels like to wind it. It's a bit, you're kind of wincing as you wind the watch because you think something's going to snap. It's not that firm kind of a metal against metal wind. It feels like metal against plastic and something's going to give. But it does tend to hang in there, and it runs really well, that Lanco. Like, it keeps excellent time. Fingers crossed it'll continue to do so. But they're an interesting movement. That when I bought the watch, the first post I put up of the Lanco was the watch itself. The second post, I think, which is the next day or whatever, was all about the movement that was inside it, because it's a pretty special movement.
Awesome stuff. Yeah, well, thanks a lot for sharing all of this, because it's really incredible watch collecting, and so far from what we're exposed to in a daily basis, that it's kind of very refreshing. I don't know what you think about it, Alex, but
I guess this is the kind of special part of watch collecting for me, where there's just all these people out there totally doing their own thing, and there's kind of no external influence on what they're doing and what they're collecting. It's what they're into, and you can, at first when I was looking at your watches, I guess there is that kind of design element that pulls them together, but then when you said you don't go for the same watches, like you try and go for something different each time, and that's true as well, it's kind of, they're all very similar but then they're all totally different. And that's such an exciting thing for me, because there are so many people that are just out there just getting the same shit that everyone else is getting. Like, that's just, people want to be accepted, and they want to have, like, they want to be able to say, I've got that as well. But so it's great when you see people like you, because then it gives other people more confidence to go, yeah, well, I'm just going to get what I like. And I think that's a wonderful thing.
It's the best thing, yes. Awesome. Well, that was an intense chat. I learned a lot of things. It's true. Maybe we'll start to wrap up, guys, if that's okay with you.
Sure, yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I've got Instagram recommendations. Alex, do you want to start?
My one is, I promised myself I was going to be prepared for this, and then as usual, as is my way, I wasn't. It's a guy who just did a review on the website yesterday, I think it was, and it's on he did a review on a Lanco watch that has a Boeing 707, I think it's a Boeing 707 on the dial, and his name is Finding Fam, but he has this whole kind of mystery of the watch and why it's got this airplane on it and 707, and he wants to know more about it. And it's great because my mum does all the editing, or most of the editing, on the reviews on the website. She's retired, so she's trying to help out. But she got super into this mystery of why the watch had a 707 plane on the dial. So she sent me through all this information, and she found out there was like a test flight of the plane, and there was like 250,000 people that went to see the test flight of this plane. And the pilot did a barrel roll of the plane. This is like a commercial plane. He did a barrel roll on the test flight, and there was 250,000 people there watching it in like Texas or something. And the owner of the company, or the chairman of the company, was there kind of pulling his hair out. But it got so much publicity and stuff at the time because, yeah, everyone was there, and then it was like all people were talking about, like, this plane doing a barrel roll, and they wanted to fire the pilot and stuff. But it really spoke to me of the kind of vintage watch thing, and I guess what you guys are into as well, all the research that you do at the end of it. Like, you find the watch, and that's just like the start. And it can be, sometimes you can have a watch for like a year, and you're still finding out new stuff about it. So it's a really good review. But yeah, the guy is Finding Fam on Instagram,
and the watch is fantastic.
Yes,
it actually has paper airplane indices.
Yeah, yeah,
it looks like paper airplanes.
It does. Yeah,
awesome. That could fit in your collection, Adam.
It could indeed. I'll have to follow Finding Fam. I can see that one now. That's really cool, isn't it? And it's a Lanco.
Yeah, I thought it was suitable for today's podcast.
Perfect. And it's got a very thin coin-edged bezel.
Yeah, it has.
Beautiful. When they're that thin, it's just, you almost don't see it on the photos.
It's very classy.
Wow. Awesome. Yeah, super classy.
That's a cool piece. Brilliant. Yeah, really cool.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah. What are you going for, Adam? Your Instagram recommendation?
Yeah, I'd like to recommend a guy out of Germany. His Instagram is PeterFox570. I call him Peter Never Ending Collection Fox because he seems to have, like, when you think you've seen it all, he puts up another one and another one and another one. And he's got, he's mostly focuses on the 70s, from what I can tell. He likes his chunky divers, but he's got a collection that's so in depth. It's there's some big names in there, but there's a lot of very obscure names, but he loves every version of every model that ever, that was released by a particular brand. And he loves picking up the same design, clearly out of the same factory, but with a different logo on the dial as well. Mm. You'll see what I mean when you delve into his page. It's just endless, really colorful, chunky divers. He's got so many cool pieces and great knowledge. And yeah, he's got some
incredible.
Oh, amazing. There's a lot of lip watches in there too, Benoit, so you should like that.
Yeah, cool.
And Yema. There's
Oricost Spiro Technique.
Yeah, the Spiro Technique, that was one of the first ones I remember looking at and seeing the little diver on a dial and then seeing some more. And then that's when I started to go in and there's companies, and then there's the tag case and all this kind of stuff. And it was such an interesting thing to get into. So yeah, he's got really nice collection.
Didn't know that account. It's awesome. There's an orange coral Nicolet watch chronograph with blue subdials. Oh, crazy stuff.
He's a serious collector. Wow. Yeah, he's got some amazing pieces. Some really beautiful Mulco watches. I've got a Mulco myself, and it's an excellent brand. He loves his, you know, bright yellow, bright orange divers, vintage divers. It's you can spend a lot of time on his page.
Yeah,
I just found he has a Rolex OP from the 50s with the shark teeth indexes, which I had one too, and they are pretty hard to come by. And awesome.
You could say he's the kind of same era of watches as you, but the kind of the tool side of it, right?
Yeah.
You're more of a dress watch person, maybe, Adam.
Yeah, I like your dress watches, and I do like skin divers. I'm not as much into the proper diving watches like Peter here is. He's got some real big, chunky, thick 70s divers and 60s divers. But more dress watches for me generally.
That's an awesome recommendation. I'm loving it. And to mine, I'm going to recommend someone maybe in the same vein, but from the other side of the Atlantic. For me, and the other side of the Pacific Ocean for you, which is Satellite 73. So like a satellite, SATLLITE 73. And he's a US-based, I think he's a teacher, school teacher. And he has a vintage collection, which is mostly based also on maybe quirky pieces, very old, and lots of American watches too, with Hamiltons, with Elgin. I'm hoping to have him on the show someday because he has a really interesting collection, and he can pull things off like he does jump hour Sundays. Weekends are for jump hours, with crazy jump hour watches. And I'm always surprised by his feed, and seems like a really nice guy with a lot of taste. So Satellite 73.
Yeah, I follow him already, but lovely watches in his collection. Yeah.
Yeah, he's got some really interesting ones, interesting case shapes, that tonneau case and you know, other rounded rectangular cases as well, a lot of Hamilton and Benrus and those interesting American brands, or that used to be American. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah. And those jump hour watches, which have kind of a close front, you know, which is pretty cool. No jump hours on your side, Adam. I don't remember.
No, not yet. I haven't yet delved into jump hour watches. I do like them. I guess I haven't found the right one for me yet.
But you've got that one with the running seconds, which is a disc.
Yeah, that's
which I really like.
Yeah, I wore that the other day. That the brand is Hislon. It's a Swiss brand that was popular in Turkey, and it's got a Wandering Seconds, which is no seconds hand of any sort. It's a rotating disc that it's, you know, numbered 1 through to 59, I think. Maybe it's 60. I'm not sure. But that just slowly rotates, and it's a different way of displaying the seconds. That's a bit more subtle, but it's really cool. I like wearing that one.
It's just brilliant. Well, you know, thanks a lot for everything. I think we'll just wrap up now. And thanks a lot, Adam, for coming on.
Thanks,
a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. Alex, thanks for thanks to the Podfather for co-hosting with me.
Thanks for having me.
I love that.
Thanks for having me. It's great. Yeah, everyone go check out mechanical_time. You really, it's great education and watches there. And yeah, thanks for coming on. It's been really interesting. I'm going to go now and spend the rest of the day on eBay looking up all those French terms. I'm going to get all the stuff before everyone else does.
Yeah, that's right. Get it quick.
And I really want to say it's one of the most refreshing accounts on Instagram, because it's so out of the park and different. And it's always a pleasure to see what's coming up, because it's always unexpected and different. And just keep going, because it's awesome and I love it.
Thanks very much, Benoit.
And okay, so to close this, there's a ritual question. And Adam, this is the last thing we're going to say. You can answer this question in whichever way you want.
Mm-hmm.
Adam, what is your next watch going to be?
My next watch is going to be something that most people haven't heard of, and that will probably need a strap change straight away, because I won't like the strap it came on.
Oh, don't say anymore. That's perfect. Perfect. Just let it hang there.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, guys. And follow Fifth Wrist. Leave a review, Adam. Leave a review on the website of one of your, you know, unknown watches. That would be so, so cool, and I think it will please Alex and his mum. So follow Fifth Wrist, leave a review, listen to the other shows with Roman, with Alex, with Rob, with everyone. Listen to Jean-Claude Beaver show that has just dropped today, if you haven't had a chance to. And everyone, stay on time.